again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all of our interviews by visiting our website at www.authorsaudio.com. Click on the listen icon on the homepage or the iTunes icon, and you can listen from there. We're going to be talking today about a small but very empowering book co-written by David Suzuki and David R. Boyd, called simply The Green Guide. For more than 30 years, David Suzuki has been the voice for nature in Canada and in many ways for the world. David was born in Vancouver, Canada at the age of 6. During the Second World War, he was sent to a Japanese internment camp with his family. After the war, the Suzukis moved to Ontario. Growing up with a passion for nature led David to earn a PhD in zoology from the University of Chicago. By 1971, he had his own show on CBC. 8 years later, he debuted a little show you may know of called The Nature of Things. David is no stranger to accolades. Al Gore praised him for challenging Canada's environment minister on this country's Green Plan. His series, A Planet for the Taking, won an award from the United Nations. He is a Companion of the Order of Canada, and he finished 5th in the CBC's search for the greatest Canadian. For me, he is the greatest Canadian, I can tell you that. He's also authored 43 books. His latest one is called David Suzuki's Green Guide, a How-To Guide to Being a Green Citizen. David R. Boyd is one of Canada's leading environmental lawyers and author of influential works including Unnatural Law, Rethinking Canadian Environmental Law and Policy. He lives lightly on Pender Island in British Columbia, and I'm very happy to welcome David R. Boyd to the program. David, how are you doing today?
I'm delighted to be on your show today, Jake, to discuss some of these ideas with you.
Well, David Boyd, it's a wonderful thing to have you on the program, and thanks for coming. I have read your book, The David Suzuki's Green Guide, that you co-authored with him, and I must say it's just a real gem, a real companion for walking into the age of new paradigms as far as how we live and how we use our natural resources. I was amazed to find out just how wasteful Canadians have become over the years, and this has got to change. As we all know, this has definitely got to change. We can't go on like this, and this book, it really gets you there, and I do highly recommend it to all my listeners. How did this book come about between you and David Suzuki?
Well, I've known David Suzuki for quite a few years now, and we were actually together in Boston at a symposium at Harvard University. And, of course, David gave a barn burner of a speech, and as soon as his speech ended, there were literally probably 200 people with their arms in the air wanting to ask him questions. And the question that everybody wanted to ask was, what can I do? What should I do? And, of course, that's a question that's impossible to answer in a soundbite or in 2 minutes. And so I said to David afterwards, I said, you know what we should do? We should write a book that answers that question. What can I do? What can an average person do? And so that was really the genesis of the idea for this book.
Well, one of the first things that I get asked a lot and people talk about a lot is climate change. And as you know, there's a major discussion all over the world whether it is or isn't, but you know, I've heard people say, oh, climate change, what the heck are you talking about? This is the coldest winter we've seen in a long time. I thought things were supposed to be warming up, and there's a lot of snow out there and everything, and basically I guess we're not looking at the climate the way scientists look at it from a complete worldwide perspective. And that if we think that just by looking at one spot on the globe that we're going to be able to see the overall warming, this is not the right perspective to really have. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, climate change is part of a global process, so it doesn't really have a lot to do with the weather in any particular place at any particular time. But pretty much all of the scientific evidence that's out there, as reported by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, shows that the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over time as a result of human activity is changing the planet's climate. And the most visible, visceral evidence we have of that to date is the shrinking of the ice cap over the North Pole. I mean, it's very dramatic when you look at how big that ice cap was, even just as recently as 20, 30 years ago, and how quickly it's shrinking. And then that triggers all kinds of feedback effects in the climate system, because dark sea water absorbs more of the sun's heat than the ice that there was previously there, which reflected the sun's heat. And so what we're seeing is really, although it's early days, we're seeing the first evidence of a truly, in some ways, frightening shift towards climate instability. And you know what's interesting is you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to go on an expedition to the Arctic to see this for yourself. You know, we notice it at home. People who have gardens notice it. People who watch birds notice it. That, for example, here where I live on the west coast of Canada, flowers are coming up in January now. The cherry trees, which used to be a spring tradition here on the west coast, the cherry blossoms are coming in early February now. Birds that we used to not see until April are showing up in March. And so it's a phenomenon that people who are kind of keeping an eye on the natural world are seeing in their local neighborhoods.
Well, once you've said that, I'm going to buy a ticket. I'll be right out.
Well, you might want to wait a bit. We're in the midst of a good winter storm right now.
Well, yes. in Toronto here where I am, it's been cold since November, and it's just really stayed cold more or less with a couple of days. So we're experiencing this, whatever it is, this manifestation of climate change. David, I wanted to ask you a question about the ecological footprint, that you talk about. And most of my listeners are very, very informed people, but right. Maybe you could explain again what that means in terms of the way scientists talk about it.
Sure. Well, the ecological footprint is something that scientists at the University of British Columbia came up with about a decade ago. And what they were looking for was a way to kind of measure the overall impact that an average person has on the planet. I mean, we all eat, we all travel, we all live in homes. And they wanted a way that could kind of translate all those different kinds of areas of impact into a single measurement. And so that's what the ecological footprint is. It's basically a measurement of how much Earth surface is needed to support an individual, and it can be, you know, scaled up so that you can have an ecological footprint for a city or for a province or for a nation. But what the science behind the ecological footprint tells us, and why it's such a dramatic indicator of our current unsustainability, is that, as you said, there's about 1.8 hectares of productive land available on Earth on a per capita basis. But the ecological footprint of the average Canadian is close to four times that level. So in other words, if everybody on Earth lived like a Canadian, traveled as much in cars and planes and heated their homes as much and ate as much roast beef and had all the gadgets in our homes like Canadians do, then we would basically need another two or three planets similar to Earth in order to meet everybody's demands. And obviously we don't have another two or three planets. And so the ecological footprint is just a very dramatic way of illustrating to people that we need to make changes both in our technologies and in our behaviors in the years and decades ahead in order to ensure that our children and our grandchildren enjoy the planet and enjoy a sustainable future.
David, I'd like to talk a little bit about something that seems to be very important to me personally. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing we've got about almost 6.4 or 5 billion people on the planet. and that the new and awakening economies and the world are looking around and saying, hey, the Western world, it's got all this stuff. We want that stuff too.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, yeah, of course they do. I can't knock that. But the fact of the matter is that if they want it in the way that we've done business before, where it's just impossible. It's not going to happen. And I go back to David Suzuki here for a moment because I actually taped a wonderful speech that he gave to the Council of Canadians about exponential growth, and it, where he talked about one bacteria in a test tube full of food, and that bacteria doubled every minute. So at 2 minutes there were two bacteria, in 3 minutes there were four, etc., etc. And he said, so when is the test tube half full? And he said, well, it's 59 minutes, it's half full. And the bacteria is saying, well, that's great. You know, it's taken 59 minutes and we're already half full. When is the test tube actually full? 60 minutes. One more minute and it's completely full. So what he did was he said, well, what if the scientists came up with an idea where they created three more test tubes and they said, hey, we've got 59 minutes, but we've got three more test tubes. Don't worry about it. We got it covered. And with the rules of exponential mathematical growth, how long would it take to use those test tubes? And the thing of the matter is, in the first minute, the first test tube would be full. In the second minute after that, the second test tube would be full. And in the third minute after that, the other two brand new test tubes would be full. So they bought an extra couple of minutes and they used up all their food. And I thought this was just a very, very eye-opening and very, very simple way for the average person to understand what kind of problems exponential growth can cause in population and also for the need for resources.
You know, it's a complicated question. I mean, there's no question that population is one of the elements. There's kind of a classic equation that people use when talking about the overall impact of humans on the planet, and the three factors that are taken into account are population, affluence or the economy, and technology. So, you know, the bigger the population, the bigger the impact. And the reality is that, I was at a lecture just recently in Vancouver, and the lecture was being given by Paul Ehrlich, who's a globally respected scientist. And he said that when he was born, there were about 2 billion people on the planet. So in his lifetime alone, we've seen more than a tripling of the world's population. The good news about population is that it's leveling off. That exponential rate of growth is slowing down, and the best current information we have is that if today's trends continue, the global population will peak sometime around the middle of this century, at somewhere around 8.5 to 9 billion people, and then it'll start to decline. In places like Europe and Japan, the population is already has already leveled off and is declining. So it's a situation that in the experience is that if you emancipate women, if you enable women to get educated and to join the economy, then the number of children that are given birth on a sort of per woman basis just falls naturally. You don't need any kind of radical policies like China's one woman, one child policy. Things will take care of themselves if we take care of women.
One of the things that I really liked about the book right away, David, was the way you and David Suzuki made it a point to be very concise about your ideas and simplify the kinds of things that the average person can get right into now to change their thinking in terms of the way they used to do things and the way that we can do them now to produce far less garbage, use far less water and electricity and so on, because by doing that, for example, in electricity, that's electricity we really don't have to make by burning coal or whatever. And so maybe you could sort of speak to that on how you worked on that with David.
Sure. Well, what we did for this book, kind of in essence, was we delved into the science and we found out what are the biggest uses of energy and what are the greatest causes of pollution in an average person's daily life. And then we found that close to 80% of the energy and pollution that an average person generates are from just three areas, from your home, from your transportation habits, mostly driving and flying, and from the food you eat. So we really focused our recommendations in those three key areas. And using electricity use is a great example. I mean, everybody uses electricity in the home, but there's literally dozens of different things that individuals can do to reduce their consumption of electricity in ways that actually not only will reduce their environmental impact, but will save them money, and in many cases, make their homes more comfortable and make their quality of life more enjoyable. And the single top recommendation for what people can do is to hire what's called an energy auditor. These are small consulting businesses where people have expertise in all of the different aspects of home energy use, and they'll come to your house, and basically it's like going to the doctor for a checkup. You know, the doctor will ask you questions. They'll take down a bunch of information. They'll perform some tests. Well, home energy auditors do the exact same thing. They'll ask you questions. They'll check your power bills. They do an amazing test with a high powered fan to see how leaky your house is, and then they'll provide you with a report on what are the most effective things you can do to fix up your house and change it in ways that will save you energy and save you money. Service they provide costs between $200 and $300, depending where you live in Canada. And I can tell you that 90% of people who get a home energy audit will save that money back in the first year.
Well, I'd just like to remind you that we are talking to David R. Boyd, the co-author of The Green Guide, along with David Suzuki of Canada. And this is a really must-have little book for people that want to be more self-empowered in terms of things that they can do themselves, not only for the environment itself, but for themselves. They can save money, they can save energy, and they can start to live in tune with nature rather than living just more of a self-centered kind of life. We must do this. We all know this because we are preparing a way for our future children. The great thing about it is, David, is that the innovations are already here. We have wind power. We have solar power. We have all kinds of solar power. We have even tidal generators that can generate electricity. And, you know, they're making cars that run on compressed air over in Europe and also, I believe, in Australia. Electric cars are now something that are being produced and are going to just become more and more and more efficient. And this is such an exciting turn of events and time to be alive. And maybe, David, you could just expound on this a little bit more for our listeners.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I can give you a real-life example because I also do some consulting work on environmental policy for the government of Sweden. And I was in Sweden last year, and they're very proud of this townhouse development that they've got in a city called Malmo. And I went there, and, you know, they're beautiful. It's a beautiful series of buildings. And I had a tour inside one of the units, and it's, you know, it's a comfortable home. And the most amazing, what's amazing about this particular townhouse development is that there were no furnaces, no heaters, no heating system of any type in those buildings. They were just built with super, super thick insulation and the highest quality engineering. And they're so energy efficient that they don't need a heat source, even though they're in Sweden, which is, you know, a cold northern nation. So this, as you say, these kinds of technologies, these high technologies that we can apply to our buildings are available today. And in the course of doing research for our book, David Suzuki and I came across examples in every Canadian province, in every Canadian state, and across Europe of buildings being built that actually generate more electricity than they consume. So they have either geothermal systems or solar panels on the roof. And instead of writing a check to your utility on a monthly basis, people are getting a check back because they're putting more electricity into the grid than they're taking out.
Well, there you have it, right from the author, the co-author of The Green Guide, David R. Boyd, when he's telling you that corporations are setting themselves up to sell energy back to the grid. Now just think about this. 50 years ago, that would have been an absolutely unimaginable, unheard of situation. So you see, times have changed, and sometimes we have to shake ourselves loose from the old ways and say, this is now possible. You can be a homeowner selling energy back to the grid if you think about it when you're building your home or upgrading your home, and as David said, getting an energy audit and having them show you how you can bring your house up to par. So this is a very exciting thing. It's exciting for me to get a check in the mail rather than a bill in the mail. And this is where we're going. So I hope everybody gets on the bandwagon. And David, maybe you can continue a little bit more of some of your ideas that you've run into.
Well, that's right. I mean, you take an example right now. We're in the middle of winter. It's cold outside. There's nobody in Canada who would prop open their front door with a brick and leave the front door open with the heat coming out of their house and going outside. Nobody would do that. But in reality, our houses are built so poorly, they're so leaky, that air is getting out of our houses through cracks and through under doors and around windows. And we're also, I think something we haven't talked about, is that many of the so-called modern conveniences, televisions, video recorders, electric toothbrushes, those are plugged in all the time. And even when we're not using them, they're consuming electricity, which is just a complete, it's like flushing money down the toilet. So our book includes some tips on the kinds of simple things people can do to avoid that kind of just absolutely pointless energy waste in their homes.
Well, the really neat thing about this book, David Suzuki's Green Guide, is that it's a primer for the average family. And you can go out and get the book, and really it's wonderful to have at home and go over it from time to time and remind yourself what other things that you can do, because this is really a book about saving money. And a lot of people probably thought, oh, well, this green revolution, this is going to cost me tons of money. No, actually, it's the reverse. You're going to have less in heating bills. You're going to have less electricity use, less water use. Your car, if you choose properly, is going to use far less gasoline. And if you use hybrid, even less. And eventually, all electric cars are just right around the corner. And as I see it, David, people are going to start to use their pocketbook to start talking with their pocketbooks, and this is going to drive the self-empowered individual and the whole planet into a much better situation regarding ecology and allowing nature to really once again sort of come back from the edge, and we are on the edge right now. So it's really fascinating. And you do talk about a very interesting thing about house sizes, which is, you know, I hadn't thought about myself, but it's really interesting. In 1950, the average house was about 1,000 square feet. And I grew up in a house like that, and then it went in 1970 to roughly 1,500 square feet, and then 1990 to a little over 2,000 square feet, up to 2005 where you left off, which is about almost 2,500 square feet, and of course, they are going up.
Yeah, I don't know what people are, I have no idea what people do with all that space, but it's certainly the trends are going in the wrong way. So we've got houses that are growing by 500 square feet every 20 years, and we've got families that are getting smaller and smaller. I mean, the average family size back in 1950 was quite a bit larger than it is today, and the average house was quite a bit smaller. So part of this is just kind of common sense. There's no reason to have these huge rambling houses when your mortgages will be lower, the time you need to spend cleaning will be less. You'll have one of the things that we really emphasize in this book is that some people have a misconception that living a more environmentally friendly lifestyle actually requires a bunch of sacrifices somehow, and that will lead to a less enjoyable life. And all of the research we dug up points in exactly the opposite direction, that taking these steps, the kinds of steps we outline in the book, whether it's one of our recommendations is for people to take a little bit more time off to spend with their families and their friends, or spend more time outside, whether it's in the garden or walking in the park. These are things that actually contribute to human happiness, which is really what it's all about for us as human beings. The reason we work, the reason we do all of the things we do is to try and achieve at the end of the day a level of happiness for ourselves and our families and our friends. And many of the things that people can do to reduce their environmental impacts will actually make them happier at the end of the day as well. One example of that we thought was particularly interesting was surveys have been done of people about the happiest parts of their day. And what we learned was that people who drive to work consistently rate their drive to work as the most frustrating, irritating, and unhappy part of their day, particularly in major cities like Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal. And people who walk to work and people who ride their bicycles to work consistently rate that as one of the best parts of their day, when they're outside, they're getting fresh air, they're getting exercise, and it's really, for many people, one of the high points of their day. So that's just one example of how the opportunity is there for people to shift their habits in ways that will make them happier, healthier, and also greener citizens.
Well, you cover the use of water in the homes. I was amazed to find out we use really only 5% of the water that we use is used in the home. But the whole topic of water is an amazing thing. There's only about 3% of the Earth's water is fresh water, and from what I was able to gather from research, I could be wrong here, but about 2/3 of this is tied up in glaciers and polar ice caps, and that only 0.3% of the fresh water is surface water. I found that just amazing, and a lot of that, or a great deal of that, is in the Great Lakes right here in Canada in the United States, and it's just incredible. So we really need to take care of the water we have, because we really don't have a lot when you start thinking about these kinds of numbers.
Yeah, that's right. And this is another example of where changes can be made that will have absolutely no negative impact on people, but will actually, again, protect the environment, save society money. The average Canadian in their home, in their daily life, uses about twice as much water as the average European. Well, why is that? Is it that Europeans, suffer from thirst, or they're an unclean people? I mean, of course not. They're modern, and in many ways they're more modern than us. But what it is that Canada and Canadians have just fallen behind. We've taken water for granted. And so, you can still go into a hardware store in Canada and buy a toilet that uses 13 liters to flush, 13 liters per flush. Well, that's not even legal in Europe, because there's technologies that can do the flushing job for half or a quarter of that. We've got appliances, washing machines, dishwashers that are just inefficient. And so over time, what we need to do as Canadians is we need to replace all of those inefficient fixtures with things that are actually use water and value water for the invaluable resource that it is.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about energy production, David, and you do cover it in the book. Nuclear energy, for example, is one that is a very, very misunderstood subject and kind of energy, really, because it is not a clean energy as they advertise. There's a whole lot of oil-related products that and energy that has to go into the extraction of the uranium and so on and so forth. And there's always the possibility of some kind of a meltdown or release of radioactive gas and so on. And of course, we have the whole business of nuclear weapons around the world, which is like a whole other topic. But I gather you're really not a big fan of nuclear energy, from what I understand.
Nuclear power, the problem with nuclear power is what do we do with the waste at the end of the day? And until we solve that issue, I think we should be very cautious about going down the nuclear path. There are dramatic developments coming in terms of some of the clean, green, renewable sources of energy that we talk about in the book, such as the development of solar power plants in some of the warmer parts of the world. So California, Florida, a number of countries in Northern Africa and the Middle East are building these solar thermal power plants that produce just as much electricity as coal-fired generating plants or nuclear plants, but they do so using the energy from the sun, which is a completely renewable and virtually no-impact form of energy. There's high-technology forms of solar panels that are now being printed on rolls of metal as thin as tinfoil, and in time, those thin-film solar panels will be coating people's houses, coating office buildings, coating vehicles and trains, and we really are perched on the edge of a clean energy revolution, and I think that we'd be much better off as a society to direct our energy and our resources and our efforts into trying to develop those sources of energy rather than grappling with the major problems that still confront nuclear energy.
You know, at this time in history, it's a very interesting time to look around and see what's really going on because, you know, it really shows what Klingons people really are. And I use that in both the Star Trek terminology and other ways, too, because, you know, of course, everybody's looking for a bailout. The car industry needs a bailout because they can't go on. What does that tell you? That tells you that they're not selling something that people want to buy. And yet the Japanese are selling cars, so they must be making something that people want to buy. And I find that this is really an age right now that we're talking. This is the age of change. And there's so many changes that are going to happen because they have to, and people are probably going to be
right.
Screaming and pulling their way through them because they don't see the change is going to be good for them. You know, it's, for example, like all the wood that is used year after year after year to put in houses to separate rooms and do all the initial outside work, all that wood every year. And of course, if it's not a year where the progress is we're not progressing economically, we're not going up 2%, 3%, 4%. Well, there's something wrong, you know. And this whole idea of progress is very interesting because progress can mean innovation and it can mean real positive effects around you where you're actually not using as much as you used to. That, to me, is progress. And the fact that we have to grow economically every year is not necessarily progress to me at all. And my little mantra for things is that if you have a problem, that's great. That's telling you something right away. You're having a problem because you're going down the wrong road. And to my way of thinking, problems are solutions waiting to happen. And once you get over that and get into that idea, it makes the whole thing kind of fun. It's like, oh, you know what? We need to solve this, but we have to do a 180 and realize that we're going the wrong way. Now everything, all the doors start to open and away you go. And that's what I see with this book. The background kind of philosophy of this book is right in there. And I think that's really great.
Yes, and I think this whole notion of change is something that fascinates me. I mean, I was gobsmacked to learn that it wasn't even a century ago, it was 1912, that horses still outnumbered cars in the streets of cities like New York, Paris, and London. I mean, that's really, really hard for a person today to imagine. And that dramatic transformation in our transportation society. So, you know, we're at a place today where people really can't imagine giving up their gas-guzzling cars because it's very difficult for them to imagine a different future. And yet, you know, as we spoke about earlier, whether it's electric vehicles or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles or something else, there is absolutely no way on earth that the transportation system in 2060 or 27 in the year 2060 or the year 2070 is going to look anything like it looks today. And so what we really need to do is stop resisting change and, you know, take more of a martial arts attitude to it and actually use the problems that are pushing us today to push us in the direction of some of these really exciting solutions that we're on the cusp of.
Yes, well, I couldn't agree more, David. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. And it's very interesting because it's just really a change in values. The change in values, which really are a change in consciousness, looking around, understanding that if I pollute this over here, that somehow that's connected to me, and it's going to come back to me one day. That idea alone has great power within it. And I think people around the world are starting to really get that, which is really exciting in and of itself. But I have to tell you, I was down in South America not too long ago. I had the opportunity to visit Sao Paulo in Brazil and Buenos Aires in Argentina. And those two cities are... nobody in North America can really understand how large they are. They're, you know, near 20 million people each. One's a little smaller, but these diesel buses all over the place, the cars all over the place, everybody's driving a little car there. The air is just absolutely a real mess, and with more people getting more cars, etc., etc., they do have a wonderful subway system, but still there's so much improvement to be made. And then I think about China and the fact that they really had to close down a lot of their coal-producing plants and smog-producing businesses around the Olympic Games there. And, you know, I just said, well, hello, there's something wrong here when you have to do that to have Olympic Games. So we all have to change. It's really the whole world needs to get on this track of thinking. And for places like China and India and other places, it's far more difficult. Societies are not as up to date, you might say, with technology, although China, I think, is going to be very quickly. They're very much into that.
It is, and China's a really fascinating example because I think the Chinese they're well aware of the fact that they cannot develop their economy and their society in the same way that Canada, the United States, and Europe developed our economies. But if were the Chinese to do that, were the Indians to do that, were the Africans to do that, it would basically spell the end for human life on Earth because of the colossal environmental impact. So China is a fascinating country. They've got all kinds of problems with their pollution, but they're also working very hard to make some of these dramatic changes that you and I have talked about. The biggest company, the company that makes more solar panels than any other company in the world, is a Chinese company. China is investing incredible amounts of talent, of education, of money into coming up with solutions that will enable them to leapfrog over the kind of dirty industrialization that we've engaged in into a clean future. And all of us, really, we should be doing everything in our power to help China along that path, to lend them a helping hand where we have technologies that might help them out.
Well, yes, and I think that very issue you brought up about the fact that countries like China and India simply cannot grow in the same way that the Western nations grew, especially North America, with this gobbling up of all these resources pell-mell at a relatively cheap price at the time. We were very fortunate to get those things at that price at that time and have the technology to create this amazing lifestyle we have. But at this time in the evolution of our species, we just can't afford to do that anymore, and we're going to have to, like you said, it's a very important point that isn't talked about enough. We're going to have to give these countries almost like a giant leap, like just move a step ahead.
That's right.
Over where we were to this new level of thinking in order to for the world to sustain itself. And I think that's a very important point you make. You also talk in the book, and I just want to touch on it briefly, but you talk about the way we look at food and how it's much better, of course, that we go back to the old style of buying food locally, which is fresher, and we can actually get a much better handle on how it's growing and what kind of conditions it's growing in. And also in terms of sustainability for the local farmers, and the fact that it also is going to cut down tremendously on transportation costs. It just goes on and on and on, these kind of ideas. And you bring them forward so well in the book. I just wanted people to be aware of that.
Yeah, it was actually the food chapter of this book that probably surprised David and I the most. I mean, we learned that children in Canada today, children in Canada and the United States and some other industrialized nations, for the first time in decades, actually have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And that's directly because of the obesity epidemic, which is leading to a diabetes epidemic. And so this huge health crisis that we're going to have to come to terms with, could be completely avoided if people ate healthier diets. And in general, healthier diets for individuals are also healthier diets for the planet. The food we eat doesn't get talked about nearly enough when people are talking about the kinds of changes they could make to reduce their ecological footprint. But studies done by scientists show that switching from a kind of conventional North American diet that's heavy on meat and heavy on processed foods to a healthier, not a radical no meat diet, but just a healthier diet with less meat and more wholesome foods, more fruits and vegetables, you could basically cut your CO2 emissions by the same amount by just changing your diet as by trading in your gas guzzler for a hybrid electric vehicle, which just puts it in perspective of how important people's choices at the grocery store and at restaurants really are.
Well, our time is coming up a bit short at the moment, David, but what I wanted to ask you is maybe in a very concise way, for the average North American family, what are some of the most effective and simplest things that they can do right away to start to get on this green path that you and David Suzuki and many others around the world are talking about and actually acting on? What are some of the very important and simple things that average person could do?
Well, really, you know, our book, one of the things we tried to do in our book was not to overwhelm people with 1,001 different things they could do. And that's why we really sifted through the science and decided to focus on the things that really make a difference. So in terms of your home, you know, get an energy audit of your home and follow the recommendations those experts give you. If you can buy green electricity, switch to green electricity. If you, you know, the average Canadian American moves 12 or 13 times during their lifetime. So the next time you're packing up your house, think about not only the, you know, your dream home, but think about where you live and how much nicer it would be if you didn't have to drive everywhere. If you could walk to the park, if you could walk to the grocery store, if you could walk to work and walk to your friend's house. Try alternatives to driving. Try taking the bus once a week. Try riding your bike once a week. Try walking on a daily basis. When you go to trade in your car, buy the most fuel-efficient vehicle you can that meets your needs. You don't have to, if you live in the country and you need a truck, there's hybrid trucks coming out that have a electric engine and a gas engine. So there's no more excuses anymore. Everybody can do their part. When it comes to eating, you mentioned try and buy local food, try and buy organic food, try and eat a little bit less. You'll be healthier, and your wallet will be fatter, and your impact on the planet will be smaller. In terms of, you know, so we covered the house where you live, we covered how people get around, we covered what people eat. Then we have another chapter that's kind of a catch-all chapter on all the other stuff people buy, and we have a bunch of principles in the book on how people can become more sustainable shoppers. And then the other thing that we haven't talked about, Jake, that I really want to make sure we touch on, is that it's not all just about being consumers, because David Suzuki and I feel very strongly that people are citizens first. And so we have a section in the book on what we call green citizenship. And there we talk about things people can do, like voting for politicians at the local level, at the provincial level, at the state level, at the federal level, who have strong environmental values and who are standing up for the kinds of things you believe in. Yeah, people can write letters to editors. They can speak out on environmental issues, you know, with the internet. As you're demonstrating, there's ways people can have their voice heard that we never would have dreamt of 25 years ago. People can volunteer. There's over a million Canadians that give up some of their precious time to volunteer for nonprofit organizations. Well, people may think about volunteering for a local environmental organization, or donating to environmental charities, or choosing a career in an environmental field, whether that's doing stream restoration or building wind turbines, or, you know, the sky's the limit. And these are the exciting thing for young people today is that this is a tremendous area of future opportunity. I mean, this is the way the world is going. And so just wanted to emphasize that there's more to it than just what we buy. There's a whole range of activities in life, from how we work, how we vote, how we invest our money, where people can make different decisions that are still going to make them better off, but are going to make the planet better off as well.
It's very interesting because I think back, and I was a big fan of John Kennedy, and he, you know, when he stepped out in the 60s there and said, you know, I think we should be able to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And he was one of those great forward-looking thinkers and forward-looking individuals in many ways. And he said that, and, you know, everybody around said, well, that's just a joke, you know. What if this guy doesn't know what he's talking about? But, in fact, because of the commitment there, and that's what I'm honing in on, the commitment to do something with the right individuals saying the right things to people is such a major part of this whole dynamic that you and David and many other people around the world are trying to get across to people. And I think, you know, it is a make or break time, but I think, you know, where people are starting to tune in on it. I really do.
I do too, and I love the fact that you brought up John F. Kennedy. He's a hero of mine, and I'd just like to maybe close with a quote from him. This is John F. Kennedy in 1961. He said, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air, and we all cherish our children's future. So there you have a guy who was 50 years ahead of his time, because those words are just as powerful today as they were the day he spoke them.
Thank you for reading that, David. That was a very inspired speech by a very inspired president. We've been looking for that kind of inspiration, I think, for quite a while since. And who knows, maybe it's coming around the corner. But I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to be on Authors Audio. I want people to know that they can get this book at most bookstores, The David Suzuki Green Guide, also co-authored by David R. Boyd.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure being on your show, Jake, and I wish you all the best with Authors Audio.
Well, it's been a great, great pleasure for me to talk to you, David, and to talk about this really excellent book, David Suzuki's Green Guide. I'd like to also say that you can visit and find out more about David by going to David Suzuki's website at davidsuzuki.org. There's also the David Suzuki Foundation that you can go to. You can become a member of that also and take part in the work that they're doing. And with that, this comes to the end of another edition of Authors Audio. This is Jake D. Steele saying, keep dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.